Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Arizona mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like song, and man, my song's gon' break through like a running back.
This is so bad. Hello and welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. My name is Mark Hamilton. Joining me from afar today, my friend, my colleague, my co-host, my frenemy, Mr. Mark Daly. Mark, you are on Vancouver Island in the city of Victoria, British Columbia. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I've been here all week for work and just packing up. By the time everybody starts listening to this, I'll be back home and, you know, have a long week of meetings and everything behind me and ready to relax over the weekend. And boy, I need the time to relax. It's been a pretty intense week, let me tell you.
For those not familiar with the Pacific Northwest, of course, our largest cities are all on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, but we're also blessed with some beautiful Gulf Islands, and all of these islands are connected with ferries, so you'll often see my social media where I'm on a ferry traversing back and forth, but Daly, for professional responsibilities, is often in Victoria, which is on Vancouver Island, about a 90-minute ferry ride away. My parents are also there, so coincidentally, I was also on Vancouver Island, but I just got home a couple of minutes ago. But my friend, we've got some exciting stories to get through today. We also have the Spanish Grand Prix, which is like the dessert after a really, I don't know how to say it, but it's like the delicious, tasty, sweet dessert after a really, really tough Burt main, which was Monaco, because of course Monaco doesn't necessarily produce great racing. But my friend, where did you want to get started today?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's give a quick shout out to the Race Weekend magazine. You can head on over to their website, theraceweekend.com, and that is RACEWKND.com, and enter in our promo code ScuderiaPod at checkout and save 10% on a subscription. And then also go and check out RacingExclusives.com. Thies and the crew have provided us with a fantastic half-scale autographed Max Verstappen helmet to give away for the winner of our fantasy league this year, and that comes with a certificate of authenticity, so you know it's the real deal. So go and check them out as well, racingexclusives.com. And also a shout out to JT the Human, the artist that created that incredible opening music for the podcast. So first of all, let's before we jump into the Spanish Grand Prix and some of the news making the rounds this week, I want you to break this one down. I'm not quite sure how to follow this one, but this is a stat that you got by Sad Walrus 86 on Reddit, and it's wet weather wins by driver and wet weather races that they participated in and their win percentage. So there's some interesting names in there and probably some not all that unsurprising. So why don't you take it away, Hammy?
First of all, Daly, you are the smart one that when I tee up a very technical, mathematically complex stat, I need you to unpack it, not just for the audience, but selfishly because I need to understand it. But yeah, a really cool little chart that was produced by, again, I love it, Sad Walrus 86 on Reddit. And basically what he's done is he's taken a view of the number of races that each driver has competed in that were wet and the number of wins that they actually accomplished from that bucket. So if you look at this race here, Michael Schumacher is arguably, could possibly be the greatest driver of all time. I think there'd be some fierce debate amongst the Team LH crowd. But according to the statistic, he competed in 44 race or 44 wet races, and he won 16 of them, meaning that he had an almost 40% win rate when he was competing in a wet Grand Prix. Lewis is second. He's competed in 37 wet races to date. He's won 13 of them, so he has a 35% win rate in the rain. Ayrton Senna competed in 18 wet races, won 10 of them, so he has a 56% win rate in the rain. Jenson Button's at 18%, of course, far fewer races. Max Verstappen, this is probably the one that's most relevant given where we are in the current state of the championship, has competed in 16 wet Grand Prix. He has won 5 of them, so he's a 31% win rate. And then finally, the last one that might be relevant for this conversation is Fernando Alonso. In his career, and he's competed in more than 350 Grand Prix now, he's competed in 42 wet Grand Prix, of which he's won 4. So his wet win rate is actually relatively low. But if you actually go and look at where he was racing when many of those wet weather races happened, they were very early in his career, or they were during that period of Mercedes dominance. But yeah, just a couple of interesting statistics that Michael Schumacher, a 36-37% win rate in the rain, and Lewis Hamilton, 35% win rate, and Ayrton Senna, again, a much smaller sample because tragically his career was cut short, but a 56% win rate in the rain. Incredible.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, even though Ayrton only raced in 18 wet weather races, but I mean, Lewis, not all that far off Michael Schumacher. I mean, 37 for Lewis compared to 44 races for Schumacher. I mean, 7 is quite doable if Lewis, you know, and the speculation is that he's going to re-sign with Mercedes, so he should be around for a couple more years. So perhaps he might get closer to that. I mean, he's only 3 races off, you know, tying that. And he's only like Lewis's win or wet weather win percentage is 35.1 compared to 36.4 for Michael. So that's pretty good, but amazing for Senna, 56.5%. That is absolutely stunning.
Daily, okay, I have trouble staying out of the ditch when it's raining and I'm driving to Walmart. The fact that these guys could win Formula One Grand Prix in the wet is absolutely, absolutely remarkable. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here because I'm kind of excited to introduce this topic. But last week on the podcast, I finally announced that, hey, my condo on Lance Stroll Island is up for sale. I'm done. I love him. I wish him nothing but the best. But I am now convinced that what we are seeing day in and day out after 6-7 years and 100-plus Grand Prix is maybe about as much as we're going to see. And there was a really great chart that I pulled here off of Formula1.com. And it calls out the number of points scored as a percentage of total team points after round 7 in Monaco. Verstappen has scored 58% of the Red Bull points, which actually seems a little bit lower than maybe you would have guessed. Fernando Alonso has scored 78%. Lewis Hamilton up on George Russell with 58. Carlos Sainz at 53, Ocon at 60, Norris at 71, Hülkenberg 75, Bottas 65. And then, of course, in the case of Williams and AlphaTauri, because they've scored so few points in total, they're largely irrelevant, but Tsunoda scored 100 and Albon scored 100. But the reason that this is relevant is, one, I got a ton of feedback this week about those comments that I made about Lance Stroll. And a lot of them were people that were, hey, you know what? Kudos. You know what? Again, your opinions evolved and it's so great that you're not going to die on that hill. And surprisingly, a lot of the feedback was no. He's an incredibly talented driver and he's going to be successful. And a couple of days ago, friend of the show, Randy, one of my good personal friends, had sent me a link to a story on crash.net. And there were some interesting quotes here from a former Formula One driver, Juan Pablo Montoya, and he was quoted as saying, and I quote, "Lance has come a long way, and I think Fernando is going to make him a much better driver. I'm okay with what he did with a car as fast as he had. You can either sit in line and do nothing or try. If you sit in line and do nothing, you might be lucky to get a point or two. If you go for it and it works, you look really good. And if you don't, you missed a point or two. Lance has an opportunity. Lance is a lot better than people think he is, and I think he's very underrated. He's a really nice guy, which I wouldn't disagree with, and he's really quiet, but I think he needs somebody on his corner to kick his ass and go, really, buddy, you lost 2 tenths here because of what? He needs to come out of his comfort zone in a way that's going to be a couple of shunts, and he did that in Monaco trying. I'd rather see him try than just sit there, because the next time he does it, if the guy knows he's coming, when you are passing somebody and they know you are coming, they'll give you the room because you know you're okay with hitting them. And he goes on and on. But finally, he concludes, I think Lance is more than good enough to hold his own in F1, according to David Crofty. So I thought this was interesting. And I responded to Randy because he sent me this story on WhatsApp, and I responded with a voice note. I'm just like, dude, like, look, I'm not buying this, right? Like, this is a guy who came into Formula One in 2017. And he was partnered with Felipe Massa. And admittedly, and I think subsequent to that, Lance Stroll has come out and said, look, Felipe Massa wasn't exactly a great mentor to me. In 2018, of course, he was partnered with another pay driver, and that was a one-year deal. He had a couple of years being partnered with the far more tenured Sergio Perez. He was partnered with Sergio Perez when Sergio won a Grand Prix. And then he had 2 years partnered with of course, Sebastian Vettel. And I don't buy now that after all those years and all of those experiences, and given the fact that he's in his mid-20s and he has 7 years of Formula One experience, that all of a sudden now something's going to click and Fernando, of all people, is going to be this great, great mentor to him. So I sent him this voicemail note, and Randy had actually responded with a voice note, which we're going to play right now if we're cool to get that teed up. But I thought it was very insightful. So if we can play that, that would be great. And then maybe both you and I can respond to it.
Sure. Here we go.
You know, it's funny because for Felipe Massa, Massa didn't care. Massa thought of Stroll as the competition, the boss's boy, the all of that. He was, I don't think that he probably said five words to encourage or assist or anything. He viewed Stroll as much the enemy as anybody else on the track, I think. I don't think there was any mentoring. Mentoring was the word I was looking for. I don't think there was any mentoring there. Perez, Perez doesn't strike me as anything resembling someone who would mentor either. Perez sees himself as a number one top driver. You know that it burns his ass that despite the fact that there was never any f-ing question when they were bringing him in, that it was all about Max. And he was just the other guy in the other car. And his job completely was as a support team, every bit as much as the guy who puts on the left rear tire for Max. Vettel, I think Vettel was very much a mentor, but not for Stroll. I don't think he gave a rat's ass about Stroll. Every time you saw him doing his mentoring, I say act, but not his mentoring role. It wasn't Lance that was beside him. It was Mick. Mick was much more his teammate than Stroll. And again, could my perception be wrong? Sure. But that's what I saw. I didn't see any, there was none of the body language or chemistry even suggested that he was there supporting and mentoring Lance the way that Fernando is. And again, I like this Fernando Alonso much more than the guy that had the same name from years ago who made Max look humble and giving. So I think from that standpoint, I think it might not matter. I think the expiry date may be just out. I think it may be just too late to pretend that Stroll is a fresh new face with skills. I think he does have skills. I think he's a way better driver than his record shows, but I don't think it's because of necessarily any hard luck. I think it's because he's a guy who's grown up with a lot of support, and I suspect that his, you know, I suspect Formula 3 came easy to him. And like so many drivers, the skipping Formula 2, I think, was probably the death knell, because there's a big performance gap between those two cars. However, let's face it, there are very successful drivers in those two support series that get in an F1 car and fall apart. So maybe that's what he was going to be. I don't know that it really changes anything. I don't necessarily think that, you know, they should be hanging in there for one more year. I think if he doesn't show some significant gains like he was showing in those first few races, I think they still put a bullet in him. But
Daly, your thoughts? I kind of teed this one up. My thoughts, hey, I don't know that he's, and I think sometimes you, to be mentored, you need to want to be mentored. And I don't know that that's what he wants. And I don't know that he's receptive to it. And maybe he's just never had the mentor, because like, and I saw you nodding your head feverishly that, yeah, you know what? Sebastian Vettel was a phenomenal mentor the last 2 years to Mick Schumacher.
To Mick Schumacher. Yeah.
Your thoughts 100%. On Randy's comments.
Yeah, I think the comments are on point. Like, you know, it was pretty obvious that that Massa wasn't really in that headspace. That you know, he probably thought that was beneath him. And Sergio, that's kind of an interesting one, right? Because you know, has that reputation of being like the ultimate team kind of person. Because when things started going south with like Force India, like he was the one that kind of triggered that whole administration thing and kind of forced Vijay Mallya out, and that opened the door for Lawrence Stroll and his consortium to come along and then, you know, take over that team and inject money into it. And a couple of years later, it morphed from Racing Point into Aston Martin. And, you know, this year Aston Martin really looks like it's getting together. But I don't know. I think he's a good teammate, but like Randy says, he thinks that you know, he has, you know, an opinion that that he is like a top driver, right? And he might be like a good team guy, but being a good team person or guy doesn't necessarily mean that translates into being like a mentor or something like that. That, you know, I definitely think that he goes there and does what Red Bull needs him to do, for example, but, you know, or where he is right now, but when he was with Racing Point, was with Lance, did that necessarily translate into mentoring Lance? And the Vettel one is kind of interesting too, because that was the one that came up all the time, that, you know, that you know, Seb is such a great mentor and blah blah blah. And exactly like you said and Randy said, he was mentoring Mick Schumacher, and, you know, has a discussion that they're really good friends, and there's almost kind of like this, you know, father-son relationship. He kind of looks out for him, because where was it they had the coming together last year? It was in Miami, right? Where Mick got a little bit you know, punchy and shunted Sebastian, I think it was in turns one or two or whatever it was. So yeah, it's kind of funny that you know, he was kind of brought in to be that, you know, that, do you want to call him a father figure at Aston Martin? And it was sort of implied that, that he was going to sort of teach Lance the tools of the trade, and that he would, you know, assume the role after Sebastian left or retired. Because I mean, by the time he went to Aston Martin, it just kind of seemed, it was like a question of when and not if he would retire, right? And the whole sort of feeling was that he would kind of like help Lance step his game up a couple of notches and bring him up to a much higher level. And then, you know, he retires after the end of last year, and there Fernando comes in. And again, like, has it ever been like publicly said that Fernando is going to be that mentor, or is it just kind of implied, where you kind of have like this age gap between like Sebastian, Fernando, older driver, multiple world champion, comes to a team like Aston Martin, which is developing. You have Lance, which is, he's too old to really be a prospect anymore, right? you're mid-20s. Yeah. It's not like you're a prospect. You should be there now, right? You should be delivering on what everybody thought, like, you know, the all these skills and talents that everybody thought you had. And so I don't, maybe it was said somewhere. I just feel like it felt like it was more implied that Fernando would be this this mentor to Lance, when maybe that isn't really the case. But yeah, I think those are some great points. I don't really have anything else to add to that, other than I'm just wondering if you're, you know, leaving Lance Troll Island, can I have your extra parking spot?
At the condo building? Yes, you can. By the way, there have been no offers on the condo. Two beds, 1,000 square feet, two bedrooms, yep. a view of the ocean. It is beautiful. I do have an interesting summary of career statistics here from Lance Stroll. Right. So as an FYI, 128 starts into his Formula One career,
oh, wow.
three podiums, one pole position, 221 points. Of course, he's Canadian, but VUK13 on Reddit actually put this summary together a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was really interesting. In 2017, which was Lance's rookie year, he went up against Felipe Massa. If you remember, Felipe Massa had actually retired at the end of 2016, but came back because Valtteri Bottas departed to that opportunity at Mercedes. So in 2017, his rookie season, Massa outqualified him 17-2. In head-to-head races where there were no DNFs, Massa outperformed Stroll 8-4. The points tally, though, was actually just 43-40. A large reason for that, of course, was Stroll picked up 15 points in his podium finish in Baku, a race that Massa could conceivably have won if not for a really unfortunate late DNF himself. Top 10 finishes, Massa 13, Stroll 7. In 2018, which was Stroll's last year, his last year with Williams, and that car was an absolute pig. And that was also the year he was up against another pay driver in Sergei Sirotkin. Sirotkin actually outqualified him 12-8 in head-to-head finishes with no DNF. Stroll just eked ahead 9-7. Points finishes, although points were sparingly acquired that year, Stroll did outperform him 6-1, but that's 2 years into his career. Now, 2019, that was his first year with Sergio Perez, so 3 years deep into his career. Perez outqualified Stroll 17-3, so that was the year that he made the switch over to Racing Point. In head-to-head finishes without DNFs, Perez outperformed Stroll 13-3, and he outscored Stroll 52-21. In 2020, which was the last year that Sergio and Lance were together, Perez outqualified Stroll 10-4. In head-to-head finishes, they finished 4-4, so it was kind of a tie there. Perez outscored him 125-75, and in top 10 finishes, Perez had 13, Stroll had 10, and in top 5 finishes, Perez had 6, and Stroll had 4. And then when you skip ahead to the Sebastian Vettel years, you would assume now that 4 or 5 years deep into his career, and with some more familiarity with that car and that factory and that powertrain, that maybe it's a little bit closer. But in Seb's first year with the Aston Martin team, he outqualified Stroll 14-8. Lance did have an edge in races that were head-to-head races without a DNF, 8-6. Vettel still outscored him 43-3. And then in 2022, which was, of course, Sebastian Vettel's last year with Aston Martin, he outqualified Stroll again 13-7. So no improvement for Stroll there. He outperformed him in head-to-head finishes 8-7. And he had double the points of Stroll, 37-18. And of course, again, this year, you know, he's what, 0-5 versus Alonso in qualifying, and a mountain's worth of points behind him. So I keep looking for, I know he's talented, but I keep looking for reasons to be more hopeful than I am. And I'm just not sure if they're there. And then ultimately, like you and I talked about last weekend, ultimately, like at some point, this is going to continue, or this is going to start challenging the integrity of Lawrence Stroll's project here, which is to create a world championship winning team. You can't have two teammates whose performance, the delta between the two of them is so huge.
Well, yeah, exactly. When you go back to the graphic that you put up there, I mean, the imbalance between Lance and Fernando is that Fernando's brought home 78% of the team's points thus far in the season after the first seven rounds. So, I mean, that's not really a great performance by Lance, because, I mean, in theory, they both have identical equipment. They should both have the same car. And if Fernando's able to put it on the podium, and I think there's only one race so far that he hasn't been on the podium, right? I mean, Lance theoretically should be right up there with his teammate, because, look, Verstappen, 58% of the points scored. That makes sense. I mean, Sergio's doing a good job as well, but Max, by virtue of leading the world championship, Hamilton, 58% of the points scored for Mercedes. That makes a lot of sense too. And Sainz, 43 and 47 for Leclerc. Pretty much an even split. Esteban Ocon, 60% compared to Gasly. Yeah, Gasly's had a bit of a tough start at Alpine and Ocon as well until last weekend. But yeah, it's just when you see stats like that and compare it to other teams around them, I think that's really, really quite sobering. I mean, you would expect like the next one that's closest is Lando at McLaren, have 71% of the points scored for the team so far, even though it's, you know, they only have about 14 points. But compare that to Oscar Piastri. I mean, he's only seven races into his Formula One career, so it's going to take a while before he kind of gets where he needs to be. But, you know, from Oscar, we've seen we've seen some flashes of good things. So who knows? But certainly when just going back to Lance, he's obviously not cutting it at the moment. But it's a good one. Why don't we just jump into a quick break? We'll come back on the flip side and we'll get into the rest of the news for the week. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
That Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're going to get across that wasteland, and we're going to do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
All right, welcome back to the show and moving along onto into the news stories for the week. First one comes from Lawrence Edmondson, the F1 editor over at ESPN.com. And the story is entitled Regulation Changes to Rein in Red Bull Would Ruin F1. And that comes from none other than Mercedes team principal Toto Wolff. And obviously we don't need to go down the laundry list of stats and wins and everything that that Red Bull has accomplished in seven races this season, but I think it's very interesting, and you know, especially to come from Toto, whose team dominated Formula One from 2014 to 2020. And then, of course, Lewis, was in there with a shout to win the championship in 2021. We don't need to go down that road. We know how that story ends. But I mean, you know, the gap between Mercedes and Red Bull, even in that season, regardless if he won the championship or not, was a lot closer. I mean, before that, undoubtedly, and there's no real dispute to that. 2014 all the way up to 2020, Mercedes was in a class of their own. Excuse me. So I think it's very interesting that you hear Toto say something like that. And I'll read the quote. So here it goes. Quote, if we start putting in a balance of performance, we will ruin this sport. This is a meritocracy. Best driver and the best car spending the same amount of money win the championship. And if you break the rules and either you should be heavily penalized, but only then, but not for doing a good job. When you win in Formula One, it is a meritocracy and they have done just a good job. The car is fast in all conditions. The driver is at the top of his game. Even today in Monaco, going off at times but not DNFing is a skill. You can see that he pushed, so credit to them. We just need to do a better job. We need to catch up, find intelligent solutions, hope that our learning slope, development slope is steeper than theirs, and eventually fight for this again. It's a sport, whether it is good for the show or not. Obviously, a strong fight between 10 drivers or at least two. It's much better for all of us, but is not happening. That is why you just have to accept that and get and work to get back there. End quote. So there you go. I think that's I think that's a very good comment from Toto Wolff. And he says right off the very top of that little speech that he gives there that, you know, it's you know. P penalize them for breaking the rules. Don't penalize them for doing a good job. I mean, nobody was saying that about Mercedes during all that, that run over that, those seven seasons. They were just so much better than everyone else. And I don't think it's a fair thing to say for Red Bull, because basically, you know, when you kind of like, you know, strip it down to the basic argument is that, well, you shouldn't do that for Mercedes because we like them a lot better than Red Bull. Like, I understand that the personalities of both of these teams, you know, are quite different. And I can understand that from, you know, certain points of view that Mercedes and their drivers are much more likable and marketable and presentable. Well, maybe not presentable, but definitely marketable than the Red Bull ones, because, you know, Max can be pretty blunt. He can be kind of almost borderline rude at times. Christian Horner, as what did Toto Wolff call him in Drive to Survive? Like a little Jack Terrier, or what a Jack Russell Terrier nipping at your heels. And, you know, that's just kind of Christian Horner. So I can understand why some people, you know, don't really like them for that, but that's not really the basis of why you should penalize them, is because you don't like them and they're running away with the championship this season after winning last year. I totally get it, but it's interesting that Toto would make those comments, although I think he's just stating a fact. I think that you could just almost do a control X and a control V and remove Red Bull and just drop in any other team name in there, regardless who it is, if they're the ones doing Red Bull-like things this year. Not that he's necessarily coming to the defense of Red Bull, right, Mark?
Yeah. I'm trying to think about the best way to draw a comparison or an equivalent to North American team sports, because that's often the only thing I have the capability of doing. But Toto's sentiment is nice, but it's also a bit deceiving, because Formula One, if nothing else, is an incredibly political sport. And Daly, you watch club football and I watch a lot of basketball. And if there's a call that the players don't like, they are in the ears of the referee immediately. And they're lobbying and they're lobbying and they're lobbying. And it's very similar in Formula One, where if there is something happening on the track or a rule that team principals do not like, or CEOs of Formula One teams do not like, they are in the ear of Stefano Domenicali and they are in the ear of anybody that's willing to listen at the FIA, and they will lobby and they will lobby and they will lobby and they will campaign until there are rule changes that are advantageous to them. And as much as this is a nice sentiment from Toto Wolff, let's be very honest, the technical directives that were applied last year because of the porpoising issue and a lot of the floor changes that were introduced this year that have subsequently reintroduced dirty air to the sport were because of the lobbying that he himself was doing last year. So while I appreciate the sentiment that, hey, let them win because they've developed the best car and they have the best driver and they just have the best package, within the last 12 months, he's lobbied in a way that has significantly altered the rules around the floors in a way that actually benefited his team. Now, it ultimately hasn't been a deterrent to Red Bull because their package is so good, but it reinforces the fact that team principals can say these kind of things, but it won't stop them from lobbying and campaigning. And they do that because it works, Daly. It works. They have the ear, like especially somebody like Toto Wolff, they have the ear of Stefano Domenicali and the leadership at the FIA. And oftentimes their campaigning and their lobbying and their complaining, both in public and behind closed doors, lead to changes that are beneficial to them. So again, nice sentiment, but again, if there's an and I don't know about you, but if I'm a Formula One team principal and I've got this entire operation and cars and drivers, and I can get an edge on the competition by pushing for a rule change that disproportionately benefits me, I'm going to do that. I don't know about you.
Yeah, and that's one of the funny things, because you know, even going back a couple of years, remember that we're not that far removed that the Formula One teams had direct access to the race director in real time to complain about something, like during the race, right? Yeah, you know, and it's just, I find it kind of weird because, you know, one of my roles is in professional governance, and it's just weird. I mean, Formula One is there to, or sorry, the FIA is there as the regulatory body, and you have the teams directly lobbying for and advocating for things that are beneficial to them, right to the CEO. Well, I mean, Domenicali is the CEO of Formula One. He's not at the FIA, but you know what I mean? They're lobbying to the most influential people in the sport to try and get things changed midstream of a season to their benefit. It seems so strange. It's just like, I mean, if you're Toto and that avenue's open to you, like, why wouldn't you try and do something about it? Especially if things aren't going to your, you know, aren't going in your way during the season, and you think, well, maybe if I, you know, I press hard enough, maybe we can find some sort of favorable outcome that will serve us better. But I mean, like you say, I mean, ultimately it kind of has this neutralizing effect on the new regulations, and these cars, you know, have kind of been, you know, they're handcuffed and almost reverted back to the previous formula that we wanted to get away from for all the things that you just
so
highlighted.
True, so
it
true.
Just, it just, I don't know. It just really, it's strange, and it's frustrating, and it's kind of maddening. And the thing is, like, all these things like that are, they're just sort of baked into Formula One. It just, it doesn't seem right. I can understand, like, when it comes to the officials that are actually out there on the court, on the fields, on the ice for other sports, or the umpire that's behind home plates, you know, they're calling the things that are happening right there on the field of play. You know, you think that was a ball rather than a strike, that, you know, he should, you know, you struck the batter out instead of, you know, that being ball four, and you're given the walk, or is it, you know, missed PI call at a football game. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, you know, this heat of the moment, you know, then, and I accept that, that the athletes and the players that are out there, you know, they're going to voice their opinion. And I mean, the thing is too, that you have in so many sports, you know, the option, if you're a coach on the sideline, to throw that flag out there and get like a real time review. And Formula One, I mean, I understand Formula One is different, motorsport is different, but it seems that, you know, they're not really, well, I mean, the one thing is the avenue to complain to the race director, which I guess would be the closest thing to being like a referee at the racetrack. That avenue is gone. They can't appeal to that person. They can't appeal to the stewards anymore. But it just seems strange that when it comes to like the, you know, the foundations, the rules that they have to, you know, that they have to work within and design and build these cars, that seems to be open to interpretation, and they can, you know, complain about that and get that change in the middle of the season. It just seems it's very Formula One. Anyways, I just want to kind of finish this one up. You know, if you go through and listen to Toto's comments, just compare that against the comments from Christian Horner after the Monaco Grand Prix last season. You know, their point of view, or at least Christian's, is very much different. And he says, quote, "There's so much jeopardy. You saw on Sunday with the weather, and there's so many factors that can go wrong, and the competition is so strong that, you know, anything can happen. So we're just taking it one race at a time," end quote. So it's kind of interesting, right? Like, even though I guess you could say that they've had things go their way this season, but, you know, they just have the right person in the right car with the right engine at the right time. And it's just like all these good things are aligning. It's just like, that's interesting that he should say that the competition is so strong. There's all these other things going on, so many things that could potentially go wrong. And maybe that, you know, for Red Bull is the best way to approach it, is just, you know, take it race by race by race, and just not try and let, you know, the season and the results get away from you. Because, you know, until you cross that magical line in the sand somewhere at that point in the season where mathematically nobody can catch up to your driver for the World Drivers' Championship, this thing could still be won by 19 other drivers. I mean, how realistic is that? Not very. mean, there would have to be a lot of things that would need to go wrong to prevent Max from winning another world championship this season. But I just find it very interesting that little quote there from Christian Horner kind of gives like a really good insight into what he's thinking. Okay, moving along, just talking about Mercedes a little bit more. This comes from Matt Q over at autosport.com. Article is entitled, Mercedes F1 has climbed from awful in Monaco to just not good. So that's the thing. I love these Total Wolf comments. Anyways, when talking to autosport.com, Toto had the following to say, quote, it's so difficult to assess because we were in the mix with Aston Martin and Ferrari. I would say on a positive note, maybe encouraging because we have never really been good here. We have been 3/10 behind pole. Last year was 6/10. This car was awful last year, and this time around the drivers said it's not good. So there is a step in the description, but we really need to be careful. We've got to go to Barcelona, collect more data. It's a new baseline. I don't expect us clearing Aston Martin and Ferrari there either, end quote. So anyways, interesting from Toto, but I guess any progress at this point for Mercedes is good progress. The car's not getting worse. I mean, it's just not awful now. It's just not good, but it's funny. I think that, he really brought up a good point saying that Monaco typically isn't a track that they've done well at. When was it? Like 2017, 2018? Remember they had a horrible, horrible weekend there and they basically went back to the factory. And of course, this is pre-cost cap and they threw everything, including the kitchen sink, at the car. And they had like a week or 2 weeks or whatever it was before they flew out to Montreal for the Canadian Grand Prix. And then that's when Lewis broke Senna's record for the poles, career pole positions and all that. And then it was no looking back from there. And the question really is, it's not if, but when they're going to figure it out. I mean, they made a big, bold step to get away from the design concept that they've been working with over the last couple of years, the side podless concept on the W13 and this year's W14. And this thing's going to be a bit of a patchwork, kind of a Frankenstein kind of thing, because they're trying to make modifications and upgrades to a car that wasn't great to begin with. So are we really going to see this quantum leap forward from where Mercedes has been over the last 18 months? Yeah, I don't think so. I think that pretty much echoes like Toto's feelings as well. And especially if the car just isn't good to begin with, it's not going to magically get better overnight. I just find it really funny that they stuck with this philosophy so long. And the best time to walk away from that philosophy was after Abu Dhabi last year. Put all the focus into that for this year, even though that 2023 car was still it was well in development by the end of November last year. But it's just funny that it would have been easier to walk away from that concept in November 22 rather than April 2023, 6-7 months down the road when you're already well and truly into the new season. That's what I find funny, is that they really believed in this concept up until very, very recently. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
It's almost like you're driving along in the winter on an icy road and you crash into the ditch, and then the tow truck comes and pulls you out and you're like, I'm not going to make that mistake again. And then you immediately hit the throttle and slide into the ditch on the other side of the road. That's kind of what happened to Mercedes here. That last year was a write-off because the concept and the car and the aerodynamic formula was just so fundamentally broken. And to your point, rather than scrapping that after Abu Dhabi last year and coming back with a totally revised concept, they doubled down, man. And I get that at Monaco, they introduced a new suspension. That's great. And they introduced a new floor. Great. And they introduced some new side pods. But the reality is, I think the things that are making this car really problematic to drive are the things that we probably can't see. And those aren't things that they're going to be able to fix during the campaign. And in a way, you and I talked about this so much back in 2021, that we talked about, some teams are going to get that formula just right and they are going to run away and win championships. And that's Red Bull. And some of these teams are going to get it so wrong that it's going to take them years to recover. And I think that's Mercedes. And again, McLaren, and I think a lot of teams on the grid would kill to have the W14. Like, if that was their baseline, they would love it. But Mercedes isn't any team, right? They're one of the most well-funded teams. They've got some of the best infrastructure in the sport. They've got arguably the greatest driver in the sport. That sitting a point or two out of second place in the championship isn't where they want to be. So again, it's nice that they brought some upgrades, but to your point, I don't see them winning races this year. And I think really it's not going to be until next year where we can maybe be excited about a Mercedes again, because I don't think we're going to get excited about the W14 in the sense that, hey, it's going to be competing for races in championships. And it's remarkable that Mercedes has found themselves in this pit of despair that's now going to extend for two straight championships.
Yeah, you know, considering how good they were until not very long ago, it's a very, very strange place to be, that you could expect that maybe Red Bull would have caught up to them at some point. Like, we saw them converging for a while, and then they were ahead of them in 2021. Well, I mean, 2021, that was still fairly even. It went back and forth between Max and Lewis all season long, but 22, I mean, that gap that where, you know, they kind of were crossing paths, right? I mean, Red Bull were on the ascendancy, and you know, Mercedes was coming down the other side, and that gap has still remained rather large even now.
Let me add one more thought, Mark, before we move on to the story, because as you're talking, this kind of occurred to me that I think from 2014 to 2021, we gave Mercedes an awful lot of credit for being able to develop these great Formula One racing cars and this great power unit to propel it to all those championships and those race wins. But when we sit back and we think about the fact that they were winning those championships in a non-cost cap era, they may also have been a hugely inefficient team, that they may have been less efficient than all of their competitors, and they may have been spending twice as much money to get comparable results. And ultimately, because they effectively had an unlimited budget, they could spend their way out of any problem. But now that we're in a situation where it's an engineering challenge, but everyone's operating under the same budget, you have to start wondering about the talent of the people within that organization, the decision-making, because, hey, in the past, maybe they made a lot of bad decisions. But to your point, you know, you just go back to the factory, cut a couple of checks, and 2 months later, you have a fundamentally new chassis. That's not an option now. So all of a sudden, I think the talent and the decision-making of the engineers and the aerodynamicists and the senior managers and the directors in the factory, all of a sudden, those decisions are much more important than they would have been in the past. Because if you make a bad decision, that's going to live with you for months or maybe years. And some of the decisions that Mercedes made dating back to late 21 when they were building the 2022 Challenger are with them today. And it maybe speaks to the fact that, hey, Mercedes was really good and they won a lot of championships, but maybe an awful lot of that was just derived from the fact that they could afford to make more mistakes than other teams because they could spend their way out of those holes and out of those mistakes.
Yeah, that's actually a very, very interesting point that you should bring it up, is just because they had this huge workforce, they had this unlimited budget to work with, they could literally just throw money at a problem on the car until it disappeared, and it didn't matter, you know, how they did it. And maybe that was the thing, is that they were able to engineer their way out of problems, but who's to say that they did it in the most efficient and, most logical and quickest way. I mean, you know, it might be, a completely different story now. Maybe that's part of the problems. The process that they had in place were just not good enough. And now they're kind of struggling because they don't have the option to throw unlimited, bundles of cash at the car to engineer out of a problem. They just can't do that now. And maybe just the way that they are is preventing them from getting out of that hole quicker than perhaps they might have done otherwise. All right, let's take another break. We'll come back on the flip side, talk about a couple more things before we talk about the Spanish Grand Prix this weekend. And we'll do that in just a moment. So please don't go away. We will be right back.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
All right, moving along to the next story. So Alfa Romeo is leaving Sauber at the end of this season before they transition slowly into the Audi Works team in 2026. And that has opened the door to potentially, well, for Alfa Romeo, that is, to potentially partner with Haas as their 2024 title sponsor. So this is really interesting. So I don't know if this is, how much legs this story has, because if you check the news today on Thursday, June 1st, that Haas isn't really confirming it. You know, they're kind of like backing away from this. But I mean, it just kind of makes sense that if Alfa Romeo is out there, they still want to, partner with the team on a sponsorship deal. Haas would be that team, just considering that Alfa Romeo falls under the umbrella of other brands and marks that under the same parent company as Ferrari, and that Haas is part of the Ferrari family by extension because they have a little corner at the factory in Maranello, and there's people wearing Haas t-shirts and overalls and stuff in Maranello doing whatever it is that they do because they have this technical partnership with Ferrari. So I mean, just from there's a lot of commonalities. I just kind of find it interesting that even after the last couple of years that Alfa is still willing to throw money into Formula One in a capacity that is just purely a branding and marketing exercise. I mean, they're not putting any technical know-how into any of the teams there that they've, well, I mean, they've only been involved with Sauber. Haas remains to be seen, but they're not throwing any human power behind it to design a better car or a gearbox or an engine or whatever the case may be. I'm just kind of fascinated by the fact that they might just want to stay in just because apparently they think that they're getting good exposure in the sport and it's a good marketing kind of thing to do. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, and to be fair, the story hasn't been confirmed, and I think you and I have been refreshing the browser quite a bit this week in the hopes that it would be. And it's Dieter Rankin, who's generally pretty on the point when it comes to stuff like this. But I think, as we all know, Alfa Romeo has been partnered with the Sauber team for a couple of years. It's been purely a branding exercise for Alfa Romeo. They've had no technical involvement in the development of that car, and I think they were cool with that. And I think even last year, there were some quotes coming out of the Alfa Romeo company stating, hey, look, you know what? There's different ways to be involved with Formula One, that a manufacturer can be involved without having technical input into the car. And of course, it made sense for them to be partnered with Sauber because Sauber is by an extension of Ferrari customer team. And of course, Alfa Romeo and Ferrari fall under the same corporate umbrella. This deal makes perfect sense. Of course, Sauber is going to become the Audi Works team. They're going to abandon their partnership, their technical partnership with Ferrari. That's long established. Haas, though, is probably as close to a Ferrari B team as you could have within the confines of the current regulations. To your point, they have a corner office at Maranello that they're so close when it comes to that technical partnership. But Haas is also a team that is endlessly in desperate need of funding. And that's how they ended up partnered so intimately with Uracali. And of course, fortunately, that's over. And it's how they became partnered with Rich Energy. But I think this could be a real way for them to turn the corner. And I think the deal, as it's reported, is going to be worth $20 million per year. And I think for Haas, that's a not insignificant deal. And presumably, they would become Alfa Romeo Haas MoneyGram F1 team powered by Ferrari. And I think in this case, it's actually, to me, it makes sense that Alfa Romeo would pay to have their name on the car and not have technical input, because ultimately their sister brand Ferrari is the one that's designing the gearbox and the suspension and the power unit anyways. And it would would seem like a weird duplication of efforts if you had two different manufacturers within the same corporate structure kind of doing the same thing. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think this is a smart move, and it keeps a kind of a vaunted manufacturer on the grid in a, like you said, largely a marketing capacity, but they're there nonetheless. But I think this will be huge for Haas, and hopefully this does a lot to propel them from a competitiveness perspective. The other consideration here, and this is a little bit less relevant, of course, is that after 25, Ferrari is going to lose Sauber as a customer team, which suggests, and we've obviously seen this in the further and tighter integration between Maranello and Haas and the Ferrari team, is that I think there, if it's possible, that integration might become even closer. And I think based on some things I've heard, that there could be some financial arrangements to nurture the Haas team a little bit more in terms of its development. And it's also understood that Ferrari is very hungry to have more participation in the driver decision making there. And of course, I think if Alfa Romeo, which is part of the Ferrari corporate umbrella, is coming aboard as part of that deal, they may demand something like, hey, we want to have direct input into who's going to be driving your cars. But an interesting story nonetheless, and that could happen as soon as next year.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on it and see what happens. Okay, one more story here before we get into the race preview for this weekend. And this is an article from Ian Parks over at speedcafe.com titled Rossi Hopes Damning Words Sparked Alpine Monaco Upturn. And this was it about 2 weeks ago now? We were talking about that that Renault CEO Laurent Rossi, he basically ranted about the poor start to the season that we'd seen from Alpine. But this past weekend, immediately after this, I wouldn't go as far as a tirade, but the statements that he had, which were pretty scathing about what Alpine had done through the first half dozen races of the season, he had to say the following, quote, "I'm happy for the team. I would hope..." And so he's then asked about if his comments in Miami had been motivating. He said, quote, "I hope so. It's a bit early to say that, but it certainly had one effect, which is to say that we're not going to be satisfied with this. There's a couple of things that we need to improve. The performance of the car, as I said back then, will take time. It needs regular updates, upgrades on the car, and we will do it. Operational excellence, they did it, and I'm glad. And that's then the mindset. They have also exhibited a very good mindset over the past two races, and whether my remarks worked or not, they are now doing what was missing, so I'm happy," end quote. So I mean, he's being very, very generous on the the fact that Gasly got a seventh, Ocon got a third. I mean, it's great. I mean, both cars in the top 10, one of those cars on the podium immediately after what he said in the media. But to me, it just seems almost a little bit premature to say that all of a sudden now they're doing the things that I wanted them to do all along. Does that mean that they were culturally just way too relaxed going about their jobs in the factory and on the pit? Well, maybe that was something. I mean, it's only one race. That's a very, very small sample. So we'll just have to keep on Alpine. But certainly, like we talked about it at the time a couple of weeks ago, Mark, very, very strange for someone like Laurent Rossi and his position to come out and say things publicly like he did about Alpine at the time.
Yeah,
agree or not?
Definitely. And it seemed very much of those criticisms, although I think probably intended for a wide swath of individuals. I think probably no one bore the brunt of those criticisms more than, of course, Otmar. But I think ultimately, I think the result in Monaco, while their best outcome, their best weekend of the year, if you look at the timeline of when Rossi had made those comments in Miami, this team didn't fundamentally change the car because they simply didn't have the time. And I don't think they made significant personnel changes in Enstone. And if they did, those people that were added were probably only in the process of being onboarded. That I think those comments may have a long-term impact in the way that they manage their business. But ultimately, I think it's more coincidental than anything that they were able to score that P3 and that P 7 finish here. Now, my friend, I know we've got to get on to Spain, yep, but there was one more story that I forgot to put in the outline, and I'd love to comment on it real quick. But this is an article from Adam Cooper over at autosport.com, and the article is entitled F1 Urge to Rethink Horrendous Gearbox Costs. And this is a really interesting story because today gearboxes are considered, I believe, transferable components, which means that teams can either A, build the gearbox themselves, or B, they can buy gearbox components from another team and package them together so they fit within the construct of their car. Now, interestingly, Mike Crack from the Aston Martin team has some interesting thoughts on gearboxes and the future of gearbox construction in the world of Formula One. And the context here, of course, is very important. That last week, you and I talked about the fact that starting in 2026, Aston Martin is going to become an official Honda Works team, which means that Honda is going to supply them with power units exclusively. Honda, though, doesn't build gearboxes. Today, Aston Martin doesn't build gearboxes. Today, Aston Martin buys their engines from Mercedes. Today, Aston Martin buys their gearboxes from Mercedes, meaning that in 2026, they've got to build a gearbox for the first time. A bespoke gearbox from the ground up. So this is an entirely new muscle that the Silverstone squad is going to have to develop. And it's also an incredibly expensive muscle. So says Mike Crack, if you look at the gearbox these days and you compare it with other motorsports categories, the gearbox is not a performance differentiator anymore. Everybody has more or less the same performance from the gearbox, but the cost for gearboxes is horrendous, especially if you compare it to other categories. So in a cost cap world, it's a question that you have to ask. If it makes sense that you go with such complicated technology, if there's no difference in performance, every team is just writing off $8 to $9 million a year for gearboxes where there's no performance difference at all. And he continues, we have been in talks with the FIA about it, or we've been in talks with the FIA about whether it makes sense to go simpler, go more cost effective on gearboxes with simpler technology, and also maybe less units per year that you would need in an attempt to just make the whole sport more sustainable. So it's interesting, right? That in the light of the fact that his team is now going to be responsible for developing and building a gearbox from the ground up, all of a sudden he's of the mind that, maybe that this could be a standard supply component. And of course, a standard supply component is the FIA going to a common supplier and saying, hey, you're going to build the gearbox based on these specifications and sell it to all the teams. And I think that Mike Crack, now that he's inherited the responsibility of building a gearbox, is saying, I don't know if we really want to do this. I don't know if we really need to do this. Maybe we should just have a standard supply component gearbox and everybody rocks the same gearbox because there isn't really that much of a performance difference between them. Now, it'll be really interesting to hear how Ferrari and Mercedes and Alpine react to this, and Red Bull, of course, because they're all developing bespoke gearboxes for their power units. But I thought it was an interesting conversation nonetheless. And I think it's just really funny that, hey, we're going to have our own power unit. Uh-oh, we have to develop our own gearbox. Maybe nobody should develop their gearbox. Maybe it should be a standard supply component. So interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good one to follow, or a good story to follow. But they certainly, you know, that's going to be a tough task for them, you know, in their quest to become a top team, a championship contending team, to come up with their own bespoke gearbox, like you say, and put it on the car and be successful. So we'll see. We'll see if Mike Crack has the same influence as, say, Toto Wolff does when it comes to lobbying for his team. And I'm being a little bit facetious. Okay, let's move along and take a look at the Spanish Grand Prix. So that's coming up this weekend. And then, this would have been the third of a triple header, which didn't actually end up being a triple header. The one thing I like about the Circuit Barcelona Catalunya is that they've done a lot of work to basically restore this track to its original configuration and taken out some of the little kinks and curves and chicanes here. So a lot of the things that I think kind of ruined the track or made it took away a lot of its potential has been removed. And we saw that last year with the turns 10 and 11, where they restored it to its original configuration rather than little sort of short, jaggedy things going on. And then the chicane at turn 13 and 14, that's been removed. Now you go through turn 13 all the way around to the pit entrance and then turn 14 back on the start finish. So that's you know, really, really cool to see that that's been restored. So going to be a 66 lap race. Circuit length is 4.65 kilometers. Race distance is 307.24 kilometers. And well, it's kind of hard to come up with a lap record for this one because, you know, this configuration we haven't raced on in, well, basically ever. But last year, the fastest lap was set by Perez. It was 124.108. Pole was set by Charles Leclerc and the Ferrari. His time was a 118.750. We had a podium of Max Verstappen, Sergio Perez, and George Russell. So just looking at things again, just quickly. So Pirelli is bringing the C1, C2, C3 compounds to the race this weekend. That is the hardest tire compounds in their set. Or their range, I should say. And here we go again. Mark, do you want to take it away, what we could see this this weekend?
Yeah, a couple of comments. And first of all, a huge shout out to listener of the show, Jens Wofford, who is there in Spain at the track. She's been sending us some really exciting updates and photos over the course of the last couple of days. So wish you nothing but the best. And I hope this adventure and this journey is everything that you expected it to be. A couple of things that we should watch out for is that the teams were going to be or will be testing the new construction tire that will be introduced formally at Silverstone in the early parts of this weekend. So teams are getting the first opportunity. Now, those wheels or those tires will have the same compound that they've been running all year, but the construction will be a little bit more durable, given the fact that I think the FIA and Formula One had come to the realization that the stresses being placed on these tires are greater than they'd anticipated that they would be based on the progression of the teams during this regulatory era. So something to look out for. A couple of other things that I think is interesting about this track is it typically gets a lot of criticism from viewers and pundits and analysts. But personally, I really don't object to this track. And I think it's a nice addition. It has two DRS zones. Of course, the first DRS zone being a fairly long one along the start finish straight leading into the first corner. So it gives teams the opportunity to overtake heading into that first corner, not necessarily just outbraking, but you've also got to be a little bit racy during T1. But I like this track. I have some good memories of it. It's been on the calendar, principally since I guess the early
90s. Forever.
Yeah. And it was really a byproduct of some government funding in the early 90s. I think it's a well-established track in kind of the pantheon of motorsports. I think MotoGP's been there. I think almost every series you can imagine has been there. Historically, it's been used for Formula One winter testing as well. Although I think Formula One is probably going to lean into Bahrain a little bit more than this one moving forward, simply because as the season has started earlier and earlier, it was getting colder and colder to do your winter testing at this track. But I like it, my friend, and I know you've been there personally, but do you think a lot of the criticism of this track is warranted? And the criticism, of course, is the same thing that we hear about a lot of tracks. There isn't enough overtaking. It becomes a parade. It's not particularly exciting. But to me, despite some of the flaws, I think the race organizers have worked hard to, like you said, restore this track to some of its earlier configurations, which should make for I would say a more exciting race day. But do you think the criticisms are warranted? And furthermore, what are your personal experiences of having attended this race in person?
Yeah, I think they were warranted. And I think that they've certainly tried to, you know, do something about it. That's why we've seen the changes to certain parts of the track over the last couple of years, that that they're trying to be reactive. I wouldn't say proactive. I think it's taken them a long time to get around to do something about it. But maybe seeing what we've seen at other tracks at in different parts of the world, that they finally decided, okay, well, if they're willing to reprofile and redo, say, Albert Park or Yas Marina or Zandvoort or wherever it might be, that that's maybe something that we should look at. And last year they must have been encouraged enough, I guess is the word to use, encouraged enough by the fact that they made those changes in turns 10 and 11 and restored it to its original configuration, that certainly worked. And now they've straightened out the next couple of corners as well. So we will see whether or not that actually plays out, because that chicane, especially before you went into turn 14 at start finish there, just completely ruined all the momentum that they had going around that back portion of the track. But the one thing, you do get a fair bit of like up and down change in elevation on this track. It's up at the top of a hill. It's fairly wide and spread out, but at the same time, it's a fairly compact track as well. And, personally, I quite like it. I mean, you get to really see them wind up all the way down start finish, and you go into turns 1, 2, and 3, and we've seen some exciting racing and some overtaking into that corner. Then you go around to turn, I guess that would be 4 and 5, where we saw Rosberg and Hamilton have a coming together all those years ago. And there's plenty of places that you can try and overtake on this track. And, I just hope that the changes that they've made and kind of, kicking up all the dirty air doesn't hinder them too much. But it's a great track, to go to as well for spectators. There's lots of really, really good viewing points there. And you mentioned, friend of the show, Jen Swofford, who's in Barcelona at the track right now, enjoying everything. Certainly it's a great place. It's a great race in a great city. And I'm certainly jealous that I'm not there. Considering as I look at the clock now here as we're recording, that we're 6 hours away from the first session here, first practice session. So it's going to get going pretty quick.
Daly, another question for you. We have two Spanish drivers on the grid this year, and Carlos Sainz and Fernando Alonso. This is officially Fernando Alonso's home race. And I think fans have always been... Spanish fans are huge motorsports fans, MotoGP in particular, but they've also had some strong inclinations towards Formula One because they've had some successful drivers, not least of which was Fernando Alonso, or has been Fernando Alonso. How much British racing green do you anticipate seeing in the crowd this year? Like, I guess the last time that Fernando would have gone home to race in Spain in a car as good as this would probably have been 2013, 2014 with Ferrari when they were still pretty competitive. Like, I can't even imagine how sensational the crowd is going to be and how strong that reception is going to be for Fernando Alonso this year.
It's going to be huge. I mean, compared to, say, Carlos Sainz, who really hasn't quite captured the Spanish fans, imagination like Fernando has. And the fact that Fernando's got such a good car and he's had an outstanding start to the season, they've always really had his back, and they've always been out there to support him, even when he's had terrible cars. Now he has a very good car, and I expect, Mark, like you just hinted at, I think we're going to see a lot of BRG in the stands around Barcelona all weekend long. I think he's going to get a rock star's reception if he has like a really, really good race. I mean, the place is just going to explode. I mean, if he can keep up with this this trend of his of finishing well and finishing on the podiums, I think it's going to be a massive weekend for Fernando and for his fans. I think it's going to be fun to watch if he can keep it up.
I think earlier this week the weather forecast had suggested it could be wet for qualifying, and there was a strong possibility that we could see race. We're definitely going to see a race on Sunday, but that there could be rain on Sunday in time for that race. I'm looking it up right now to see if that's cleared at all. It looks like it is good. A small chance of showers, but not significantly. And I think that's probably going to dissipate as we get a little bit closer. Your predictions at this point, I think I know where you're going to go with this, but do you anticipate any surprises if the track stays dry this weekend?
Not really. I think we're going to see, once again, I think we're going to see, Red Bull are going to be the team to beat. And I think that Fernando is still going to be a step or two ahead of Hamilton and George in the two Mercedes cars. Ferrari is just too much of an unknown at the moment. I think, like we've seen over the first 7 races, it'll probably be Red Bull just that much further ahead of everyone else, Alonso behind, and Ferrari and Mercedes kind of mixing it up in the for the best of the rest, which seems kind of strange to say. My only big question is, can Stroll get this one together for Aston Martin? Not to suggest that he might win, but just to be a better team player and support his teammates and the team themselves, bring home some points. I don't know. I mean, I think that the fact that the Aston Martin is a little bit draggy, I don't think is going to hinder them too much. I mean, I know you got like the long start finish straight, but it handles well in the corners and there's plenty of twisty components to it. Ferrari's top end speed might be a little bit of a bonus. I mean, the one thing that I could see that might be a little bit problematic is if that Fernando gets stuck behind the Ferraris and the Ferrari just has that top end speed down start finish and he just isn't able to overtake them. He could get stuck behind them for some period of time. So that remains to be seen. I mean, I wouldn't be as concerned about that if he was stuck behind one of the Mercedes, because they're not quite as quick as the other ones. But yeah, that's what I expect. Red Bull, Aston Martin, the Mercedes and the Ferraris, and then everyone else.
Yeah, I don't think I've got a point that's particularly contrarian to what you've just shared. I think there's every reason to expect that Max is going to win and that he should win big on this track. And I think he's won every race except Australia by at least 20 seconds. And of course, Australia was only kind of sub 20 seconds because you had that late restart, but ultimately he should win and the Red Bull should tear up this track. It'll be interesting to see how Sergio Perez responds after a horror shock weekend in Monaco. And, you and I talked last weekend about the fact that the turnaround being so quick is probably pretty good from a psychological perspective. He can put that weekend behind him, go and have a really strong couple of practice sessions and get qualifying in the books. I think it's going to be interesting to see how Lance Stroll responds as well. And I think, like you said earlier, Fernando Alonso scored 78% of all the points for Aston Martin this year. That's not acceptable. And Alonso has been sensational, and I would argue possibly the best driver on the grid this year. And obviously Max is the best driver and he's going to win the championship. But I think in terms of performance relative to the capabilities of the car that he's being given, I think Fernando is just driving the wheels off of what is admittedly a really good Aston Martin car. But I think it's going to be a really important weekend for Lance Stroll. And I don't think Lance Stroll is going to want to go into the summer break with this kind of delta between him and his teammate, because I think it's going to introduce a lot of really uncomfortable questions for him in the media pen, and increasingly for his dad as well. And I think the other thing I'm going to be looking for this weekend is probably going to be around Mercedes, that Mercedes did introduce a host of upgrades and they kind of expected, hey, a 2/10 improvement versus where they were before, or that a 2/10 of a second improvement would be a kind of the gold standard of what they maybe would expect to extract from that. Monaco was probably not the best benchmark for what those upgrades are going to deliver. I think Spain is going to probably be a much, much better showcase of what those upgrades are really going to mean to that car. So I think that's going to be something interesting to look for as well. And then finally, is Alpine going to be able to build on the momentum that they built so far this year, that we know that Red Bull is going to run away with this championship, but could we have a much closer battle for 2, 3, 4, 5? And obviously, I think at this point, Alpine competing for P4, I think it's probably too late for them to make a meaningful run, but it doesn't mean that they can't be in the mix with Ferrari and with Mercedes every race for the rest of the year. So some things to look forward to for sure.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's wrap it up there. And before we go, just want to just run down the top five in the driver's standings. We have Max Verstappen leading the way at 144 points, 105 for his teammate Sergio Perez in second. You have Fernando Alonso with 93 points in third, Hamilton for Mercedes with 69, and then George Russell, his Mercedes teammate, with 50 points in fifth. Over on the constructor's side, we have Red Bull leading the way with 249 points, Aston Martin second with 120, Mercedes third with 119, Ferrari fourth with 90, and then Alpine rounding out the top five with 35 points. So, thank you all for joining in and listening this week. If you want to get in touch, send us a tweet at ScuderiaF1Pod on Twitter, and also send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the race. Mark and I will be back on Sunday night to wrap it up. Until then, enjoy the race, enjoy the weekend, and we'll talk to you again very, very soon. Bye for now.